So every new film hopefully doesn't have the mistakes that the previous one had. And so I guess every movie is sort of a step forward with, of course, new mistakes, but I always feel prouder of each new film. Emotionally, I'm prouder of certain things for different reasons, but as a whole and an ensemble, when I look at It's Only the End of the World, it seems to me, at least, that it's the one that's most complete in terms of storytelling, in terms of everything.
Coming to you from the Dory House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. The voice you just heard was, of course, the incredibly talented young Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan. In this special episode, we'll take an up-close look at his work and hear from the director himself.
Without ever finding the right words, and because you are uncomfortable in your skin, and you are nervous and insecure, and everything you say is actually bullshit, and all you're trying to say is I love you, but you are too proud to say that.
And a little later,
I asked Godard that day whether any films of the modern day would ever change the world the way that his Nouvelle Vague had. He lit one of his Frenchest cigarettes and shrugged an effortlessly continental shrug.
Another chapter from the secret autobiography of our anonymous film critic. That's all to come on this special edition of The Cinema Show, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Ben Rylan. The French city of Cannes is a strange place. For most of the year, it's a fairly sleepy little place that sometimes seems to be home to far more than its fair share of luxury waterfront boutiques. But then the Cannes Film Festival comes to town and suddenly the city is bustling. Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan achieved the kind of feat in 2009 that few filmmakers have mastered. At just 20 years old, his debut feature, I Killed My Mother, made it into the director's fortnight. It picked up 3 awards at the festival and even attracted a standing ovation from the notoriously prickly festival crowd. His latest film, It's Only the End of the World, follows a young man returning home to his family after a long absence, ostensibly to announce his pending death due to an unmentioned illness. Much of the film is spent in the midst of heated arguments and on the cusp of physical aggression. Something which, given the topic of his acclaimed debut, made me wonder about Xavier's own family. I sat down with him for a chat during his recent trip to London.
There are not a lot of bridges to be built between that world, that story, and mine. This is not the relationship that I have with my family, either my father's family or my mom's family. It's just, or family at all. I don't have a tormented relationship to family. I did have a complicated, let's call it complicated, relationship with my mom. I don't have a simple relationship with my dad, but I do have amazing cousins, aunts, uncles. I love family. I go to my family and we have dinner and we play games, we play cards. I've lived at my uncle's and aunt's, at my cousin's house when I was in high school. Lived there for 3 years, and they were, I think, the best years of my life. At least the ones I am most nostalgic of.
That seems to strike quite a contrast from the kind of dramatic situations that arise in many of your films. Does that kind of tense drama still ring true for you personally?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived that with my family. Doesn't mean I haven't lived that with other human beings, other friends, or it's not exclusive to family to have, you know, the family events to have no resolution or to family members to not listen to each other. There is a lot of people out there who are not listening to you, and you are not listening to a whole bunch of people too. So that's just life. We work on our capacity or incapacity to listen and love and talk, and communicating is everything, and there are people we can communicate with. But when I read the play, I was very drawn to these characters and very impressed by their, well, their brutality and their violence, how aggressive they were and inconsiderate and yet very sensitive. And I mean, I guess how all the contradictions and contrasts in what they say versus what they feel and where they look and what they do. Does it still feel true to life? Probably someone else's life, not just not mine. I don't see why that type of resolution wouldn't feel true to life. Life is often unexplained and unjustified. We don't have reasons for everything and answers to all questions.
Some people seem to take issue with the film not revealing everything about the characters and the situations that they're in. It's almost as if you're asking the audience to step inside the house with the characters and experience the drama as they are, with all the unspoken thoughts and, all the second-guessing.
I know that people were frustrated to not know why the lead character had actually gone, why he had left home years ago without ever coming back. I know they are frustrated that I never said whether he was dying of AIDS or cancer or what it was exactly he was dying from. Does it really matter? I think that what matters is what these people have to say to one another within that given amount of time. The time that they have together, which is, what, 5 or 6 hours tops. So that's what the film is about. How you use the time you have with the people that are in front of you and how you come clean with them. How you try to be true to yourself, but without ever finding the right words, and because you are uncomfortable in your skin and you are nervous and insecure and everything you say is actually bullshit and all you're trying to say is I love you, but you are too proud to say that. So you spend an infinite amount of time just rehashing the same words and just spend so much time on that sort of, you know, mindless chatter and small talk and avoid saying the essential about how you feel towards a person, whether you love that person or not.
It's Only the End of the World is Xavier's 6th film as a director, and he's still just 27 years old, a remarkable achievement. What's perhaps most astonishing, though, is how emotionally mature all of his films feel. Let's take a look.
Madame, est-ce que je pourrais prendre le métier de ma tante?
Tu peux pas prendre le métier d'un de tes parents?
Je vois jamais mon père. Et ma mère est morte.
Bluntly audacious, that's how the New York Times described Dolan's first film, I Killed My Mother. Starring in the lead role, Dolan plays Hubert, the ferociously angry teenage son of single mother Chantal. Deep down, Hubert says, he loves his mother, but it's not the love of a son. Dolan wrote the script for this when he was just 16, making its insightfulness all the more fascinating. Resisting the temptation to venture into high drama or comedy relief, the film cleverly takes us inside the mind of Hubert, as it's revealed that, in fact, his love for his mother is exactly like that of a teenage son. With his next film, Heartbeats, Dolan takes us into an entirely new stylistic world filled with lust. Many of us have fallen under the spell of an entirely impossible crush, but Frances is young and gay and seemingly in love with the same devastatingly handsome visitor as his female best friend, Marie.
Hey! Hey! Ça va?
Ben oui, toi?
Oui, ça... Ben oui, qu'est-ce que tu fais là?
Je suis dans le coin, là, sur Jeanne-Mance.
Ah oh, oui!
Toi, qu'est-ce que tu fais?
Ben, je prenais un café avec une amie.
With a mesmerizing cocktail of extreme close-ups and wistful slow motion, Dolan invents a world of extravagance that's simultaneously devoid of romance. And it's only after all the chemistry unfolding in the minds of Frances and Marie begins to erupt that we finally catch a glimpse of who the beautiful Nicolas might actually be. In 2012, Dolan embarked on what might still be his most ambitious project with Lawrence Anyways. Teaming again with the wonderful Suzanne Clément from his debut, the film is the story of a transgender person, Lawrence, and the heavy impact his decision to transition from male to female brings upon his relationships.
Je t'avais dit ce que t'avais à faire. C'est pas compliqué. Hein?
Dolan again took the lead in 2013 with the psychological thriller Tom at the Farm, which sees him en route to the family home of his deceased boyfriend. Upon arriving at the fog-ridden property somewhere outside of Montreal, Tom quickly learns a troubling secret. His boyfriend's family never knew he was gay and can't seem to stop talking about an invented girlfriend. It's a convenient lie that the eldest son of the family, Francis, an enormous towering figure, clearly intends to maintain at any cost.
Je vais apprendre à me contrôler, à prendre soin de toi, à te protéger.
Toi, la priorité number one, école, OK? Moi, c'est à ton âge que j'ai droppé.
The following year saw him complete Mummy, his most acclaimed project yet and his most financially successful, again focusing on a difficult relationship between a mother and a son, but this time the teenage boy suffers from quite a severe case of ADHD. His mother, Diane, spends her time swatting away unwanted attention, whether for her status as a single mother with a loud son or her fearless demeanor in the face of other women. This is a household dominated by unpredictability. One moment, Steve is a loving son. Seconds later, he's stealing groceries and forcing his mother to hide in a cupboard. But the film's truly magic touch comes not from a great romance or an unexpected breakthrough, but the wonderfully simple addition of a new friend. There are some filmmakers who almost seem to invite you inside the inner workings of their minds, simply by viewing their artistic output. The films of Xavier Dolan certainly do that, and yet perhaps leave you with more questions for the creator himself than answers. A child actor turned young filmmaking prodigy, his short patience for boring questions and celebrity-chasing journalists has earned him a, well, shall we say, colourful reputation. But these are merely the titles of what we'll eventually be calling his early film career. Vain, insecure, and emotionally raw. He's all of those things, and yet by challenging that into his art, he somehow manages to find the truth of it all. We will hear more from Xavier Dolan soon. But first, another chapter from that anonymous and quite unhappy film critic landed on the Cinema Show's desk this week. If you've been listening lately, you'll recall that we've been airing these chapters from an unknown source that appear to be the unpublished memoirs of a highly respected newspaper critic. This week's edition recalls the time he sat down for a conversation with a giant of French cinema.
Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic, Chapter 4. Tell me, I said as I leaned across the table and passed the hot chocolate to Jean-Luc Godard, what do you see as the essential elements of the new wave? Obviously, I said the whole thing in French, but I understand that in the 21st century it is apparently socially acceptable even for film fans to be monolingual, so I will make the concession and translate my remarks for the listener. The important thing is Godard's answer and how it changed my life. The new wave, he said to me, thoughtfully dropping a marshmallow into his mug, is not just a movement, it is a revolution, it is not just a style, it is a feeling, it is not just a genre, it is a movement, and so forth. He stared at me with dark, unblinking Gallic eyes. When I invented La Nouvelle Vague in approximately the 1950s, he barked, I wasn't seeking to change cinema, but to change life itself. For example, he explained, my film Breathless. Before I made that, the concept of breathlessness was unheard of. I introduced Le Monde to the idea that sometimes people don't breathe at all. The world was never the same. I gasped in amazement. Godard was right. Even that gasp in amazement was proof of his thesis. I asked Godard that day whether any films of the modern day would ever change the world the way that his Nouvelle Vague had. He lit one of his Frenchest cigarettes and shrugged an effortlessly continental shrug. It is hard to say, he murmured. but I hear good things about this nuns on the run. And with that, he was gone, throwing down one of his famous smoke bombs and fleeing in the confusion. That was many years ago now, but I still reflect on Jean-Luc's words. What films today will truly change the world? And what is the point of making a film if you do not seek to change the world? Today's filmmakers have abrogated their responsibility to the human race by neglecting the big issues. Today's cinema-going public may learn how to train their dragon, but not how it's to be fed and sheltered, and whether the burden of its medical care will fall on the ordinary taxpayer. It's all very well to make a movie about a big, friendly giant, but where is the practical plan on how to make our own giants bigger and friendlier? I fear that the modern auteur simply doesn't care. Is it any wonder that our world is going to hell and nobody speaks French? My friends, it is no wonder at all.
Our anonymous friend there with another chapter from his unpublished memoir. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll talk to Xavier Dolan about what it's like to be on the receiving end of some of the harshest critique dealt by the crowds at Cannes. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
The Score, brought to you by The Cinema Show. British composer Atticus Ross and American industrial rock titan Trent Reznor may not have many film scores under their belts, but nevertheless are one of the most powerful composing duos in cinema today. Taking influences from their illustrious careers in the music industry, the pair have an exceptionally unique style when composing. They have a refreshing approach in reimagining the ways in which instruments should be recorded and played, and somehow always find their way to a luscious soundscape through a mixed path of deep oscillating tones, distorted bass lines, and roaring synth riffs. What is most unique about their work is that somewhat sparkly and euphoric resolve to what is usually a twisted journey of awkward and somewhat unconventional textures. The Reznor-Ross filmography isn't necessarily extensive, but is certainly admirable. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl, and most recently Fisher Stevens and Leonardo DiCaprio's climate change documentary, Before the Flood, are just a handful of their most exciting projects. Recognised in the industry for their innovative approach to composing, 2010 saw their finest hour when they scooped up both a Grammy and an Oscar for their score for David Fincher's The Social Network. For Monocle, I'm Kieran Banerjee.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. This week's show is focusing on Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan. You've no doubt heard whispers from time to time about Dolan's relationship with the press. He's been depicted in interviews as tired, bored, and largely disinterested in the questions being thrown at him. One interview even suggested that his 2014 film Mummy would be the one to break him into the mainstream, as if to assume that's a place he'd ever feel at home. When I met him, he wasn't at all like many of those depictions. In fact, I found his emotional honesty and lack of pretense quite refreshing. He's not aloof or impolite, and he's certainly not prone to basking in his own publicity. But it's when that publicity turns sour that Dolan has trouble.
I already have an opinion on my films when I screen them, when they premiere. I mean, of course, I've been doing, you know, the color timing, I've been doing the whole post-production for months, so I already have an opinion on those films. Do I like them? Am I proud of them? What am I less proud of? What did I fail? What did I do right? What did I do wrong? I already have an opinion. But, well, you know, you make mistakes. You know, you identify them as mistakes, whether on set already or in the editing room, and you try to not repeat those mistakes over and over again. So every new film hopefully doesn't have the mistakes that the previous one had. And so I guess every movie is sort of a step forward with, of course, new mistakes, but I always feel prouder of each new film. I mean, emotionally, I'm prouder of certain things for different reasons, but as a whole, an ensemble, when I look at It's Only the End of the World, it seems to me, at least, that it's the one that's most complete in terms of storytelling, in terms of everything. I just think that what matters in making movies is that the movie you are watching is that all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity. All the elements are aligned, and none are peaking or standing out in a distracting way. The acting of one, or the music here, or the effects there, or the sets, or the costumes, or whichever effect of camera or motion is not distracting from the story and the characters, yeah, and the storytelling and the narrative. So this is why It's Only the End of the World is my favorite one. And, of course, the reaction of people is everything. It will always affect me. It doesn't affect my vision of the film and what I think of the film, but it does affect me. It does, you know, if it's negative or aggressive or cruel or crude. Of course, I'm a human being. I can't evolve in this world if I am not sensitive to what people say about my work and how they look at it and what they feel when they see it. It's everything.
There are, of course, many artists who claim not to pay any mind to the thoughts and reactions of critics, whether we believe them or not. Dolan is a little more upfront with his attitude towards critics. When The Hollywood Reporter called his 2013 film Tom at the Farm the work of a narcissist, Dolan replied to the magazine on Twitter.
You can kiss my narcissistic ass.
But sassy quotes aside, the weight of some of the nastier critique does take its toll.
I mean, it feels awful. Like I said, I could be indifferent to that, but I don't know how I could be. I mean, I am emotionally available for these films when I'm making them and when I'm editing them and when I'm making the poster and making the costumes and at all levels of production and fabrication of those films, I am emotionally open. I don't really understand how for 24 hours presenting the film in a festival, I could suddenly become emotionally shut and suddenly very smart about how I respond to criticism. I am not politically correct and I am not smart about criticism. That's one thing that people know, I guess. Or they don't. I mean, I assume they don't, but those who know, know. Of course, it's very hard, especially when you are proud of something and when you've shown it to people who've always been harsh with you, always been honest, and their reaction has been so emotional as well. And these are people that you trust. They're people that you respect. And I still respect those people, but I do trust them. And if they've responded to that material in that or that way, it means that, you know, I trust their judgment. I trust their taste. And so you get there with the, not the certainty of, obviously, there will always be detractors and there will always be people who don't like your work and who don't respond to it. That's normal. But to be almost globally and collectively rejected by a community of a group of people is very, very odd. You feel like you're the fat kid in the schoolyard. It's very peculiar.
Now, your next project will be your first English language film. What prompted you to take that step in your career now?
The fact that it was the next story to be told. It was the next story I wanted to tell. It's not about, you know, making it to the USA, or it was just a story of fame and trying to be who you are, trying to be yourself in a system that applauds uniformity and obviously lacks diversity and doesn't celebrate identity. So, and that had been in the books for, I mean, I wanted to write that story for years, and I wrote it like 4 years ago now. It wasn't really about, you know, I wrote that film before I wrote Mommy, right after I had shot Tom at the Farm. And it's not really about working, you know, making it somewhere. It's making it somewhere, wherever, but with someone.
Some have mused that you'll eventually make that leap into mainstream filmmaking, but, well, I get the impression that that's not really something that interests you.
The goal for me really is to work with artists and actors that I respect more than in places that I dream to be working in. I have no dreams of Hollywood or no dreams of France or no dreams of... Of course, there are businesses and industries that produce an overwhelming amount of good filmmaking, and that's great. It's more about the people you work with and the places you end up in.
So then at this point in your career, you're young, you're obviously super accomplished. Looking into the future, is there anything on the horizon that you still feel like you're chasing after?
Oh yeah, I need to be acting. I need to act. I'm very unfulfilled as an actor. And I feel very lucky as a director that I've been working with such talented actors, but I do also feel that that has led me to not envy them, but want to act with them, want to act like them. I know that I have it in me to tell stories from the other side of the mirror, the other side of the camera, and I want to do that very much.
Well, that's it for today's show, which was expertly edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and royally researched by Yolene Goffin. I hope we have managed to take your mind off politics for a while. If you do still need more of a break, head on over to Mubi for a season of female friendships on the screen, including Heavenly Creatures from director Peter Jackson, Fried Green Tomatoes from 1991, and Ghost World from 2001. That's for viewers here in the United Kingdom. If you are over in the United States, well, you can look out for Tony Leung in Hero from 2002 and the Austrian film Amor Fu, which screened at Cannes in 2014. Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic is written by Ben Pobgy and performed by Barney Burnham. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.